Okay. There's a famous televised debate, more famous than ones that we've experienced in the recent past, but it's a very famous one between JFK and Richard Nixon. I think it was the first televised debate in history, presidential debate. And the famous rumor that has spread about this debate is that there was a significant difference between radio listeners and people who watch the debate. Many people may have heard this before. It's a bubble of mice that spreads around the veldt, as they say, that people who listened to the debate thought that Nixon performed better than JFK. People who watched the debate, it was the first televised debate in history, thought that JFK did better than Nixon. And they explained that the reason why is because JFK was dashing, he wore the right type of suit, he didn't fade into the background, it was black and white back in the day, and he made sure to wear a very dark suit as opposed to Nixon, who didn't. Nixon had been sick, he was recovering from the flu and surgery or something like that, and he looked all pale and he was sweating, and JFK looked tanned and he looked good. And even though JFK performed worse in the debate, people perceived JFK as looking better and therefore doing better in the debate. That's what they spread around. So it happens to be that it's not really true. It is a little bit of a Bubba Mesa, as they say. Nixon did not perform well in the debate. He was actually ill-advised by his vice president in terms of how to go about, not vice president, his running mate, in terms of how to go about in the debate. He was too much of a nice guy. He should have been more aggressive. And radio listeners also didn't perceive him to do that well. But it got people thinking, because that was dozens of years ago. People were thinking, is it really true that people perceive performance based off of looks? Is it true that people would perceive a politician to be a better politician if he looks better and looks more effective? Okay. So in 2005, there was a group of researchers from Princeton who had a very bold claim. They thought this was true. Not only was it true, they were seeking to prove that a large portion of our national elections, or congressional elections, senatorial, and into Congress, are determined based off looks alone. Nothing else. Looks matter. That's what they were trying to prove. So how did they do it? They had a study where they basically took a bunch of Senate elections and a bunch of House elections. They took the two candidates who were being chosen from, Democratic and Republican, printed out pictures of them. Now, they gave these pictures to people who had no idea what was happening in these races, none of the politics involved, none of which party each politician belonged to, men and women of these elections, and asked people to rate who looked more effective, who looked like a more competent politician. The people knew nothing about their policies, nothing about their background, nothing about their political affiliations, just simply who looks more effective. And people rated who looked more effective. So A or B. And people would say B, or people would say A. And they took the average of who people thought were more effective. And actually, people tend to rate more who looks more effective semi-consistently. People tend to look at two candidates, and they actually have the same opinion of who looks more effective, for the most part. So they took these statistics of which candidates look more effective, and they compared it to who actually won the elections. Okay, so listen to this. They found that, if I'm getting the numbers correctly, if I'm remembering correctly, in the Senate elections, the more effective-looking candidate won the election 72% of the time. Now, what does that mean? You would have expected 50%. 50% would have been half and half, which is the chance of odds, right? If looks made no difference, it would have been 50-50. That means that 22% of Senate elections are determined based off of looks alone. That's it. The way that a Senate person running for the Senate looks determines whether they win 22% of the time. House elections were 19%. It was like 69% accuracy. And this was elections from 2004, 2005. It was over the course of several years, many different elections. So basically between 15% to 25% of our elections are determined based on whether somebody looks like he or she is good for the job. It's a promising thought for democracy, right? We're in a very good situation. We really have the right type of things that people are thinking about when they determine who they should be voting for and how. It's disturbing, but it's not really. We all know that heuristics are used when it comes to making any decision process. This is something that Tversky and Kahneman, two, if I'm not mistaken, Israeli psychologists, they won Nobel Prize, I think, for their work, if I'm not mistaken. They've been recording this for years in terms of how human beings will use heuristics in order to use a mental shortcut to come to a decision process. Basically, instead of thinking about things critically, a lot of times we'll use rules of thumb, we'll judge books by the cover, we'll use certain mental shortcuts in order to determine whether we think a decision is worth making instead of actually thinking critically about it. It saves mental resources, and many times it's just autopilot. It's much easier to do. And we know that humanity has been doing that for hundreds of years. It's well recorded and well documented. I think that our nation, the Jewish nation, was forged in the Kor HaBazel of Mitzrayim, and we were branded with an inherent distaste and severe dislike for using heuristics when it comes to choosing leaders. A severe, I would say, fear or maybe even skepticism when it comes to looking at how a leader looks, how he or she talks, the charisma. We're not into that. Or at least we're not supposed to be. Let's take it all the way back to biblical Egypt for a moment. I like biblical Egypt. I've been talking about it a lot recently. Especially the pharaohs of old. We're in Mitzrayim. This is what we're leaving off in the parasha this week. We're going to be leaving off in Mitzrayim as Yosef and his generation passes away. And slowly but surely, a very charismatic, either new leader or old leader, depending on which position you take in Chazal, comes up onto the scene and decides that the Jews are a threat to Mitzrayim, or he decides that he wants to harness the raw power of such a populous nation, and he convinces his entire nation to put them under brutal slave rule. And he does it. He's very effective at doing that. He's probably very charismatic, the fact that he's able to convince everybody of doing this, the fact that he's able to connive into getting the Jews under his rule without them even realizing what he's doing. He convinces everybody that he's a god. Pharaoh's a sun god. Rashi talks about this at length, that Pharaoh convinced everybody that he was a god. And this is something that was very common in the ancient world. We talked about Ptolemy HaMelech a couple of weeks ago, or last week. Ptolemy HaMelech also did that. He deified himself and his relatives. It was a very common thing in Egypt to deify oneself as the ruler over the nation. And that's what Pharaoh did. The famous Rashi, that he would go into the Or every single morning so that he could relieve himself, because gods don't have to relieve themselves, and he would hide it every single day. He had all of Egypt under his thumb. Everything was in his control. Everything was in the palm of his hand. He was the god in total control. And I always, whenever I picture Pharaoh, I picture like a tall, good-looking guy, probably a nice tan. He was probably a charismatic, good-looking sun god. He was on top of the world. He had all it took to win that election, as they say. That's power. Onto the scene walks Moshe, a man who can barely finish a sentence without stumbling. He's been an outcast. He's a fugitive. By the way, we don't think about this, but it's possible that his control of the Egyptian language was in total disrepair. According to some commentators, he was outside of Egypt for 60 years before he came back. So he probably couldn't even speak well the language speaking. He's kaveh peh kaveh blashon. He could barely get a sentence out without stumbling. He isn't self-confident. He's not dashing. In fact, he's literally the most humble and self-effacing human being on the face of the planet. And he's the one who's tasked. Hashem chooses him to be the leader that takes Klal Yisrael from the clutches of Pharaoh's claws. He's going to be the leader who takes Klal Yisrael out. So there's no need for me to express my misgivings. Moshe does it himself, quite at length. For, in fact, 7 days, according to Chazal, he tries to convince the Roshon that he's not the right man for the job. I'm not the right man for the job. He constantly says it over and over again. I'm kaveh, kaveh, kaveh lashon. I'm not the right person. I'm not charismatic. I can't speak. Nobody's going to listen to me. I'm not the right man. And Hashem begrudgingly, if such a thing could be said about the Rosh Hashanah, begrudgingly allows Aaron to be his mouthpiece. That wasn't the original plan. Moshe was supposed to be the person who came in front of Pharaoh. So, okay, allow Aaron to be the one who speaks for you. But ultimately, the leader, the liberator, the lawgiver, Moshe Rabbeinu is Rabbeinu. Moshe is all of those roles. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu deliberately chooses him to be the one who takes Klal Yisrael out and becomes the Rabbeinu who is immortalized throughout history. Moshe emes v'saraso emes. Why Moshe? Why? I understand he's an anav, I understand that he's humble. Aaron's pretty big tzaddik also. Seems to be the right type of leader, kind of, to be leading an entire nation. He's more charismatic. You look at Chazal's. He's more charismatic. He had a way with the people. I don't know. It's very strange. It's a very strange choice. And why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was deliberately choosing Moshe? There are lots of reasons, obviously, this question. There's a lot of depth to this question. But I want to highlight a particular aspect I think comes out of the following week's parashas, Shmos, Vayirabo. To zoom in on, for a second, the entire Exodus story. What's the point of the glorious Exodus? What is the point of the Makos? What is the point of Kriyas Yamsov? What was the point of the whole light show that HaKadosh Baruch Hu conducted to get Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim? So obviously there are many reasons for it. It's one of the most multi-layered stories in Tanakh, and it influences all of Tanakh. That's why we're constantly mentioning Zecher L'Yetzias Mitzrayim. For one, Skarva Onesh. Kadosh Baruch Hu simply punished those who were evil and brutally tortured the Jewish people. The Egyptians were punished. And Kadosh Baruch Hu liberated his chosen child, the Bnei Yisrael. That was also a very important role that needed to occur. He also, potentially not most importantly, but very importantly, showed his total control over every single element of this universe. That permanently we would recognize that Kadosh Baruch Hu is the sole arbiter over anything that occurs in this universe. And that was through Yetzias Mitzrayim. Kadosh Baruch Hu Bigalui expressing his control over the most untamed natural forces of the ancient world, including the wild seed creates Yam Suf. Okay. But I think there's another role that we tend to not give enough credit for, and this is something that I've actually spoken about in the past. I think Hashem wanted us to learn a very important lesson. He wanted us to understand that leadership isn't defined by beauty and by charisma. It's defined by substance and character. Moral fiber. That's the way we define a good leader. He deliberately arranges for the Exodus to be this epic showdown between the charismatic sun god and the stumbling, humble, awkward orator who literally can't speak in front of his people. Moshe needs to be that leader that clashes with power. Let's show that through the Exodus story for a second. The whole Yitzhak from Mitzrayim, it starts with the following pasuk. Shmos Perek Zayin, it starts off. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu as he commands him to start the process of the Makos. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. Hashem says to Moshe, Re'en esaticha Elohim l'paro. Ve'aron achicha yeh nevi'echa. I have made you, it sounds, the word Elohim usually connotes divinity, the word that's used to refer to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. I have made you into Elohim, a ruler, a god, quote unquote, over paro. You are in control. And if you look, all the Mefarshim pick up on this. It's obvious what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to say. The Das HaKenim, the Rabbeinu Bachya, they all say the same thing. Says the Das HaKenim with the Balei Tosfos. L'fisha asa atzmo Eloha. Paro made himself into the god. The one in total control, on top of the pyramid, looking down at all the peons below. In total control over everything that was happening in Mitzrayim. He thinks he's a god. Shenemar, as it says in the Nevi'im, Li Ya'ori, this is my river, the Nile is mine. I'm in control of Egypt. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in response, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? Atalo Elohim. I will make you, Moshe Rabbeinu, the stumbling, awkward, humble man who is an outcast and a fugitive. I'm going to make you into a ruler, a god over Paro. Let's see how godly and divine he looks when I cast him down from his holy pyramid and show that he's a nothing and make Moshe Rabbeinu into the greatest leader in history. Let's see how Paro feels. Let's see what he looks. The sun god's being replaced. The Kadosh Baruch Hu is replacing him with a man who lacks all the beauty, all the magnetism, the egotism. Instead, he possesses moral fiber, humility, angelic holiness, as the Ibn Ezra says in this pasuk, what Elohim really means, that he was holy, an insatiable desire to serve his people. He'll do anything, Moshe Rabbeinu, to serve Klal Yisrael. He'll sacrifice anything to serve Klal Yisrael. And that is the man who's being placed on the pedestal. He's the man who's supplanting Paro from his holy throne, his divine throne. This is, I think, is the deeper meaning of the bizarre medrash. We all know this bizarre medrash that we've learned since we were in first grade, right? Moshe's playing on Paro's lap. He takes the crown off of Paro's head. He's giggling. He puts it on his head, and Paro thinks it's so cute. And then when the Khartoumim say, "No, Pharaoh, that's not good news. Remember we told you about that kid who's going to be born on that day, and he's going to be the one who's going to end up supplanting you from your throne? No, this kid's Jewish." Actually, the Khartoumim couldn't tell whether he was Jewish or Egyptian. It had to do with the fact that he was raised by both, as the Maral explains in Gevurah Hashem, not for now. But this kid, he's taking your throne up. I don't think this is such a good idea. Maybe we should get rid of him. We should kill him on the spot. And they were arguing that we should kill him. And fascinatingly enough, who defends Moshe Rabbeinu in the Medrash? This is the part that we don't usually mention. Anybody know who defends Moshe Rabbeinu in the Medrash? Medrash Rabbah? The future Shver. Yisro. Yisro gets up and defends Moshe Rabbeinu. As we know, he was an advisor to Paro. No, don't do it. He may not have Das, Yisro says. Maybe he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just a cute little kid. He doesn't understand what he's doing. Let's put it to a test. Yisro proposes. Let's put it to a test. And what do they end up doing? They place in front of Moshe Rabbeinu gold on one hand, representing the wealth and power of Paro. And the other hand, they place the coals, the famous test. And they place Moshe Rabbeinu and says, yes, sir, if he has Das, he'll go for the gold. If he has knowledge and awareness of what he's doing, he'll go for the gold. If he doesn't, he'll grab either. Let's see what he does. Let's prove that he doesn't really know what he's doing. And as the Medrash explains, Moshe Rabbeinu immediately started going for the gold. And what happened? The Malach Gavriel takes his hand, pushes it towards the coals. Moshe ends up popping the coal into his mouth. That's why he had a speech impediment for the rest of his life. This story is why Moshe Rabbeinu was Kaved Pe Kaved Lashon. What a bizarre story. What on earth is the deeper meaning of that story? So there are lots of deeper levels of meaning and interpretation. The Medrash describes how sometimes the greatest leaders of Klal Yisrael, Bedavka, are raised and threatened by the greatest enemies of Klal Yisrael. That's part of the deeper meaning of this Medrash. The fact that Yisrael is the one who ultimately defends Moshe Rabbeinu and therefore is Zoka to become his father-in-law in the future. There are lots of deeper meanings of the story. But I think there's something that's particularly going on with the coals and the gold. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to reach for the gold. He's going to become the leader who reaches for the wealth and the power, the luster, the magnetism, the charisma, the glowing, most precious substance that all of humanity has always valued most. Gold. It glows. It shines. And he's about to reach for that. And what does the Malach of Hashem do? Pushes his hand towards the coals, immediately giving him a speech impediment that would last for his entire life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in placing that bizarre test in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, was showing that I don't want the future leader of Klal Yisrael to take the throne of Paro. I don't want him to take the gold. I want him to take the charisma, the throne of Paro. Absolutely not. I'd prefer him to take hot coals and literally burn his mouth to the point where he can never pronounce a word properly for the rest of his life. That is the leader I want for Klal Yisrael. I don't want the sun god. I don't want the charisma. I don't want the gold. I don't want the riches. I don't want all the things that people stare at that make them valuable in the eyes. I don't want heuristics. I don't want any of the good-looking tans. I want content, humility, and moral fiber. And I will arrange for my future leader of Klal Yisrael, the leader who will be immortalized as the Rabbeinu, who will give over the Torah, as a person who literally has a speech impediment and can't get a word out. The coals over the gold. The speech impediment over the charisma. That is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu prefers in his leader for Klal Yisrael. And you see what happens over the course of the Exodus story. Just look. We already know that Moshe is willing to sacrifice anything for others. First of all, he does it when he saves the Jew from the Mitzri and has to run for his life for the next 60 or so years to Midian, being supplanted from his position of royalty because of his loyalty to the Jewish people and his willingness to sacrifice everything. We know how he's willing to take care of the sheep. There are stories that we could share, but we don't have enough time tonight. The famous comment of the Cheskuni as to why, as we read in the fast day this past week, why does Moshe Rabbeinu dive to the ground when the Yud Gimel Midos are being mentioned? He dives himself to the ground. And the Cheskuni says that he was actually trying to cut off the Ribbono Shel Olam before the Ribbono Shel Olam would start adding on more generations that he would punish for the Chet Ha'Egel. And Moshe quickly dives to the ground and interrupts the Kadosh Baruch Hu before he can get another sentence out. Says the Chazam Sofer on the spot, quoting from the Ibn Ezra, the Ibn Ezra says, what are you, a fool? You'd be dead. If you did that in front of a Melech Basar Vadam, a mortal king would kill you for doing such a thing. What kind of stupidity is that? To cut off a king, especially the Melech Malchei Amlachim? Moshe would be dead on the spot. Says the Chazam Sofer, you're right. Moshe thought he'd be dead on the spot. He was willing to sacrifice himself then and there to ensure that the Chet Ha'Egel would not haunt the Jewish people for more generations. To make sure that Klal Yisrael would not suffer for more and more generations for the sins of their forebears. He was willing to end it right there. He thought he was dead. And of course, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically wants that type of leader is the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was spared. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves the self-sacrifice of a leader like Moshe Rabbeinu for Klal Yisrael. Let's contrast that with Paro for a second. Paro, he's the exact opposite. He capitulates when his own comfort is on the line. Other than that, he just closes his doors and doesn't care about what's happening to everybody else. As long as he has water, he doesn't care about what everybody else is suffering with. As soon as the frogs come into his own palace, all of a sudden now he's so concerned. As the Or HaChaim points out, whenever Paro is personally afraid, especially by Makas Pokoros, all of a sudden now he capitulates. Now he's so worried. He doesn't care about the way that his people suffer. The Or HaChaim points this out already in Perichas. It's consistent throughout. And by the end of the story, Paro's own followers are starting to challenge him. They're starting to challenge him. They question him, why are you still keeping Klal Yisrael? Get them out already. What are you doing? Moshe Rabbeinu, on the other hand, take a look at Shmos Perek Yedav. Vayitein Hashem Eschena Am Be'enim Mitzrayim. When Klal Yisrael are asking to borrow for the trip away, they're asking to offer all the valuables of the Mitzrayim. Gam Ha'ish Moshe Gadol Me'od Be'eretz Mitzrayim Be'enei Avdei Paro Ve'enei Ha'am. Moshe Rabbeinu, the stumbling, quote-unquote, fool, who nobody respected, who nobody saw as a charismatic leader, all of a sudden now is a person that everybody respects and everybody looks up to as an incredible leader, including the Mitzrayim themselves, who have been suffering horribly for the last couple of weeks or months because of Moshe Rabbeinu. But they see a real person of moral fiber when they see it, and even the Mitzrim respect it. Even the Mitzrim respect the type of leader that Moshe Rabbeinu is. This lesson is baked into our nation. Don't focus on heuristics. Focus on content. Don't focus on charisma. I think it's very important that we don't rely on heuristics when choosing leaders, when choosing people to learn Torah from. And I think we've lost our emphasis on it a little bit. We're not supposed to care about charisma, witty humor, outer dress and looks. We're supposed to care about content and moral fiber. And I think we've lost that a little bit. I'll describe why. I've mentioned this in the past. I think we're Zocha in many congregations will bring over a Gedolim from Eretz Yisrael to come and speak to us. And by the way, these Gedolim come from across the Hashkafic spectrum. From all different towns. I'm not going to give any details, but Zachas V'Shalom, you'll see. I'm going to tell the story in a second. I don't want anybody to point fingers at any particular Gedolim of what I'm about to say. But great Gedolim from across the Hashkafic spectrum will come to modern Orthodox Kehillos to speak. And I've been Zocha in various different communities to hear them. And I always come away with the same impression. Yes, is it true that the English is not the best? In fact, sometimes the English is not good at all. The jokes sometimes are a little discordant, different culture, especially when it gets translated into English, not necessarily the funniest in the world. Sometimes they fall flat. The speech can be a little stale sometimes, but the Torah content is gorgeous. The Torah content comes from a person of depth, and befitting of a person of depth, the Torah content is gorgeous. Almost always. That's always the impression I walk away with. And we would hope that people would care about the content and recognize that this is a person whose fourth language is English, and maybe it makes sense that he won't be able to articulate himself so well if he's forced to speak in that language, and we'll listen to him for what he's got, for the real content and for the true character that he has. But people don't. And why is it that when I walk away, already in the lobby, I hear comments about not a good speaker, not funny, not this, not that, not that. One time I heard a person commenting on the person's weight. What does a person's weight have anything to do with the content of what they're speaking about? His body type matters all of a sudden now? Forget about the very serious transgression of speaking Lashon Hara about a Torah scholar, especially when it's in public, and especially when everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. Look at the Gemara Brachos for that topic. The heuristics are ridiculous. You're ignoring content, gorgeous content, because the jokes were a little flat? What's going on? It's ridiculous, and the fact that people are willing to talk about it out loud bothers me. And for me, it's a little personal, but you can probably tell from the title of this year. I'll tell you a story. I've done many rabbinic internships before coming to the shul, Baruch Hashem. So nobody knows exactly what community I'm talking about. And I was in a particular community, and I spoke a particular Friday night. The next day, I was eating a meal with people at lunch. And the person was like insinuating a little bit about like my speech style. Like I couldn't tell where he was going with it. So I asked him, like, do you have a critique? I like to hear a critique. I like hearing critiques. By the way, if I could pat myself on the back, I thought the content of the speech was really, really amazing. I actually thought it was a really important lesson. We could maybe share it at a different time. And he said, you started the speech with an You said before you started the speech. I'm like, okay, and how was the rest of the speech? Nothing. You started with an The rest of the speech is done. And then he starts waxing eloquent about, once I was in a shul with a rabbi who would talk politics and it was so engaging and this and that. And can you name me a single piece of Torah from any of those speeches? Or were you lost in the politics, in the luster, and all the things that you seem to be so overly focused on as opposed to actual Torah content? And I'll be honest, I wasn't so angry. I was actually felt bad for him. Because he lost out on what I thought was beautiful Torah, potentially for years, because of an It just wasn't exactly the way, it was a little discordant in my ears. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting out of the drasha. I expected it to be a little funnier, a little sharper, the point should be made a little better. No content. All outer trappings. All we care about is the tan. All we care about is the way that JFK looks. Nobody cares about what the content of the debate actually is. Nobody cares about what the Divrei Torah actually are, even though it's Kihem Chayinu V'Rechameinu, the essence of our existence. We have to remember that the Rabban Shel Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu, our immortalized teacher, from which our entire Masorah stems, was not a good speaker. He wasn't funny. He didn't tell funny stories in drushos. He probably was a little stale in delivery. And he is the Rabban Shel Yisrael. Our entire Masorah stems from somebody who was a terrible speaker. Deliberately so. HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated to be so. He wanted us to recognize that what ultimately matters is Torah content. It's not about what grabs our attention, the beautiful garb on the outside. Ki heim chayenu v'orech yameinu. What makes us tick, what makes us live, is not charisma, it's content. It's such an important idea. One of the Talmidim Muvhakim of Rav Huttner Zatzal, Rav Shlomo, he was the Rosh Shiva in Shir Yashiv, in Far Rockaway. He used to say, charisma is a dirty word. It's a dirty word. Show that you have a heart and you have a neshama and that you love a yid. None of this charisma business. He used to hate it. He was a pretty charismatic guy, if you knew him. But he cared about Jews. Charisma is a dirty word. Don't use it. It's all about content. It's all about MS and Ava. It's all about actually loving another Jew and actually presenting another Jew with real content. We can't afford to ignore a drasha just because it doesn't make us chuckle like a comedic routine. We can't afford it. We need Torah. Let me just clarify for a second before maybe I misconstrue myself. I'm not trying to say that Torah shouldn't be dressed up and shouldn't be made beautiful and shouldn't be made funny. I think it should be accessible, it should be interesting, engaging as possible. I think it's an obligation on educators and rabbis. They need to use humor, stories, dynamism. Of course we need to use that all the time. Rav Schechter Shlita is fond of noting that it's a kiyum in hiddur of Talmud Torah. You should beautify the mitzvah of teaching Torah by giving stories, humor. And he does that, by the way, in very high-level shiurim that he gives for his own kolel. He'll throw in stories, he'll throw in jokes. He thinks it's important. It's beautifying the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Rav Emanuel Feldman wrote a beautiful article in Tradition where he spoke about not putting Torah in a brown paper bag, not putting tefillin in a brown paper bag. Tefillin should be in a beautiful receptacle. And when you speak badly or when you write badly, it's as if you're putting tefillin into a brown paper bag. Nobody does that. We want to beautify our Sifrei Kodesh. We want to beautify our tefillin. We want to beautify our Divrei Torah. And it should be written accordingly. It should be presented accordingly. And I think that's true. We need to put emphasis on making sure that our Divrei Torah are delivered beautifully and that it should look good and sound good. That being said, that doesn't mean that if it's not in the beautiful receptacle and it's in a brown paper bag, it doesn't mean that the tefillin should be thrown into a recycling bin. Just because it's not so beautifully dressed doesn't mean that the Kodesh Kedashim on the inside should just be thrown into a recycling or into an incinerator. We can't afford to do that. Educators need to put emphasis on style, presentation, humor, dynamism. Consumers like us need to focus on content. We need to be focused on what actually matters. And the Rabbeinu Yonah talks about this in Pirkei Avos, in Perek Beis. He talks about how Habeishosu Petzama Es Devrayim, says Rabbeinu Yonah, says what that means is that if you recognize that you need Torah, that you desperately need Torah, it doesn't matter how stale it might seem on the outside, it doesn't matter how not appealing it might taste, it will become sweet because you know that you desperately need it. But for the person who thinks, Shalom Yali, and I don't need it, it has to speak on my terms, it has to translate itself into what I find to be engaging, what I find to be humorous, what I find to be my type of Torah, and if it's not, I'll just ignore it. If it started with an or if the person just doesn't look the way that I like, or doesn't have the same hashkafa as me, or doesn't present things in the same way as me, then I'll just ignore the content. This is all about the outer trappings. That person, the most beautiful, delicious Divrei Torah, will pass him or her by. Fly for this, just sail over the horizon. You'll miss out on everything that's important about Torah. If you perceive truth for where it's at, and you care about truth, that's where you'll get. I think there's a further danger of setting this type of trend, where all we care about is the outer trappings and the humor and the charisma. And I'll say exactly what it is, what I'm very worried about. When consumers rely on heuristics instead of critical thinking, when we as consumers care about what the person looks like, the humor that they use, there's a lot of pressure on rabbis and educators to start looking more like Paro than they do like Moshe Rabbeinu. Elections are won by people who have good looks and sound a certain way, then who cares about content so much if I can work more on my outer presentation? So not only do we not have Torah, it becomes this beautiful receptacle that's filled with phylacteries that are stuffed with newspaper. Nothing of content, nothing of Torah, nothing of Kedusha. It's better to have the tefillin in a brown paper bag than it is to have a beautiful, beautiful tefillin bag that's filled with newspaper and narishka. And we have to be very worried when we put so much emphasis on outer trappings, on the way that somebody looks on the outside. Maybe we're starting to focus on the tefillin bag instead of what's actually on the inside. We have to open up the bag and check what's in it actually, and maybe put on what's inside and see if there's actual kedusha there. We have to start making sure that we're accessing the content, on the inside. And yes, it should look on the outside beautiful, but as consumers like us, we need to make sure that we're looking on the inside, and we need to make sure that we're thinking critically about what's on the inside. We care about Moshe Rabbeinu, and ultimately Moshe Rabbeinu, the source of all our Masorah, could not speak. And that's specifically the point. And that's the point of the entire Exodus story, where Moshe is made into Elohim over Paro. The new paradigm of a true leader is the leader of Moshe Rabbeinu. Content, moral fiber, willing to sacrifice anything for Klal Yisrael. Just want to finish with a story. A story that I find to be very moving. I don't usually introduce stories and talk about how they make me feel, but I get a little emotional when I say it sometimes. There was a group of high schoolers who visited Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. And they were posing questions he used to have. I think it was from NC Swykola, if I'm not mistaken. And there was one brave kid who raised his hand and very honestly asked Rav Lichtenstein, "What do you do about the boring parts of Torah? What should we do about parts of Torah that are a little boring?" So Rav Lichtenstein's response, short, pithy, and it's perfect Rav Lichtenstein. He said, "Replace the word Torah with Dvar Hashem and try to re-ask the question." Replace the word Torah with Dvar Hashem and even try to ask that question. If it's Dvar Hashem, if it's truth, if it's the Vekas Ba'Kadosh Baruch Hu, if it's the essence of the universe and it's Torah Hashem, Torah Hashem Temila, it doesn't need any other justification, it doesn't need any outer trappings, it doesn't need to make me feel in any way. It doesn't matter how it's presented, it will catch my attention. Even what seems to me at first to be the most bitter will become the sweetest Divrei Torah. We'll thirstily drink MS when we recognize how desperately we need it and how much it connects us with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And then that's ultimately the essence of our lives and the essence of this universe. We should all be zochet to see through the outer trappings. We should always be able to find the wisdom wherever it could be found and to see through even brown paper bags to find the Kedusha therein. Everybody have an amazing night.